This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. We had a pretty big press conference from the Pentagon. Started about 8 o'clock a.m. Eastern time, and we're going to recap some of that with Congressman John James at the bottom of the hour. Energy and Commerce Committee is a lot to discuss. Senator James Lankford standing by of Oklahoma. He's on Homeland Security, Intelligence, and Finance Committee. So much is happening this week and just now as we try to make heads or tails of how much damage the Iranian nuclear program suffered, and it seems extensive. Unlike the first report we all got, and also the reflection on what happened at NATO. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
We're well on our way to getting this bill passed this week, which means we're well on our way to a stronger and more prosperous America.
And let's see, Senator John Thune, a lot has to be done. The presidential push now, turning up the heat as Donald Trump on his party holdout, standing in the way of passing his big, beautiful bill. Failure might not be an option, but it is still possible.
Number two.
The people who hate this result the most are the Democratic establishment. We have seen poll after poll after poll showing Democratic voters fed up with their leaders in Washington, fed up with their leaders in government.
And that's why maybe Cuomo went up in flames. That is CNN. Thunderstruck. Governor Cuomo blows $25 million and loses the Democratic nomination for mayor of New York City. Radical Muslim socialist Zohran Mamdani gets it. Dems are more rattled even than Republicans.
Number one.
We're going to talk to them next week with Iran. We may sign an agreement. I don't know. To me, I don't think it's that necessary. I mean, they had a war. They fought. Now they're going back to their world. I don't care if I have an agreement or not.
You should. The strike, the ceasefire, the intel. What's next? I'm talking about Iran and Israel. There are big questions we'll tackle as we look at what happens next in the Middle East. And now there's some talk about Hamas and Israel getting going about some type of ceasefire that's coupled with the release of all the hostages. Senator James Lankford joins us now. Senator, I don't know if you were able to catch the Pentagon press conference. If so, what did you think?
I was able to catch just bits and pieces of the press conference itself. Obviously, the consuming piece for the media is they want America to have failed, and they want the men and women that delivered those bombs into Iran on their nuclear facilities to not have hit it. But what actually happened was they were extremely professional. The men and women that were there that carried out those strikes hit exactly what we wanted to be able to hit and set back the Iran nuclear program by who knows how long. At this point, the message was pretty clear to them. We destroyed everything you've got. If you want to rebuild this, we know your address, and we know how to be able to come back and do this again. So don't start rebuilding, no matter what it is.
They had the IAEA says badly damaged. Iran foreign minister says badly damaged, to use other words. The head of the CIA and now the DNI said of extensive damage. Israel was on the ground, and they said there was extended damage. And now you have this, so just some color commentary. You have these pilots, men and women from ages 21 to 28, who pulled it off. And I did not know they've been working on these ways to blow up Natanz and Fordo since 2009. And they constructed the GBU-57 just for this operation, should any president say go. None of them said go. This one did.
Right. President after president for the last 20 years has said Iran cannot have a nuclear program. And President Trump said Iran does not have a nuclear program. I mean, that's the big shift.
Here is what the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said, General Kane.
The primary kill mechanism in the mission space was a mix of overpressure and blast ripping through the open tunnels and destroying critical hardware. The majority of the damage we assessed based on our extensive modeling was a blast layer combined with the impulse extending from the shock. Imagine what this looks like six times over.
So the only thing I would add to, I mean, it looks devastating. All I could say, these are the most powerful bombs ever made, non-nuclear, and ever dropped, non-nuclear. They were targeted just for this, and it was executed perfectly. What happens next is let's see how much damage is done. But the execution, the reason for it, what led to it, is beyond a doubt. It's just amazing in Washington how people can't just say, wow, that was pretty impressive. We understand how we got to this point. Now where do we go from here? But instead, I watched Senator Kelly say, well, there's no plan, it's chaos. What are you talking about? It's just the opposite.
So it's remarkable to me to be able to have folks step out and say that and say, why don't you rewind a decade ago and when President Obama put 170 Tomahawk missiles into Libya, and that did spur chaos in Libya then in the days after that. And Libya is still in chaos now. Compare that to what President Obama did, to what President Trump did. It was very specific, going after specific targets to be able to say you cannot have a nuclear weapon. That is what we have said now for decades. You do not have the capability to produce a nuclear weapon. And this is all about what the people of Iran do next. But we have executed what our priority goal was in that region, and that is to prevent the largest state sponsor of terrorism to have the worst weapon in the world.
All right. So, Senator, I know you're going to be really busy this week on the big, beautiful bill. Senator John Thune's leading the charge from the Senate, and the president is going to be speaking about it today. Cut 36.
We're well on our way to getting this bill passed this week, which means we're well on our way to a stronger and more prosperous America. That means Americans keeping more of their hard-earned money. It means American businesses growing and investing in our country and in our workers. And it means a thriving economy like we had before the pandemic.
So that's what he's hoping for. The public sentiment aside, you guys are not on the same page yet when it comes to Medicaid and SALT. Where does Senator Lankford feel? How do you feel about it?
So let me give a little bit of context to it, if I can, Brian. We've had a bill that's been sitting out there that the House passed on it. They did great work on it to be able to set the predicate for it. It's been sitting out there for a month. We've actually released the different chapters of this bill. Many of them have been out there for weeks now for everyone to be able to look at. We've got 95% of this bill we've got agreement on. We understand what we're trying to accomplish. We're doing it together. We're now on the last edges of the last pieces to be able to determine exactly how to be able to do that. So when John Thune rightfully says that we are very close to getting this done, we are very close to getting this done. It's just finalizing the last pieces. For Medicaid, we all agree we need to have a work requirement. It's the one piece of the social safety net there's not a work requirement on. We believe we should have that for healthy adults with no kids. Now it's a matter of how do we work out some of the provider tax pieces and the other aspects of it and to be able to make sure that that works. On the SALT piece, no grand secret, there's not members of the Senate that are supportive of SALT. I personally believe that federal taxpayers in Oklahoma should pay the same amount of federal tax that they pay in New York or California. But the SALT agreement sets up that New Yorkers pay less in federal tax than Oklahomans do. I don't think that's right, but we're working through this, trying to be able to negotiate with the House simultaneously to get to an agreement we can all pass.
So I understand there's a concern, West Virginia Senator Justice and Senator Josh Hawley, about Medicaid. And what they say is they're worried about rural hospitals. And you guys are thinking of putting together some type of fund just for rural hospitals?
We are setting a way to make sure we're protecting that. That's actually my primary issue as well on the Medicaid piece, is how do we make sure rural hospitals that are very vulnerable are not negatively affected by this. A lot of rural hospitals, maybe 20% of their patients are Medicaid patients in very depressed areas in rural America. Those folks need good quality access to health care, and they need to make sure it's close enough to be able to get to. If we cause the closure of hospitals, then people have to drive 100 miles to get to a hospital, that's not helpful for them. So, no, our conference has been very attentive to making sure that we're doing the steps to be able to make sure that we are specifically protecting those rural hospitals that are the most vulnerable.
So, Senator, as you know, the problem with Medicaid is it got blown up by Obamacare. There's way too many people in it for this program, and the federal government, not the state, is doing 90% of it in some cases because working-class families are now eligible. I'm not saying that they working class family don't deserve coverage, but this program wasn't designed for that. Households, the number of households covered, thanks to Barack Obama, is up 400%. Everybody wants the top coverage for everybody. I don't care how much you make. We got that.
Yep.
But how do you make it affordable that doesn't destroy the system or bankrupt the country? Besides the work requirement, what could you tell people?
Yeah, the work requirement is the biggest aspect of that. It is when you hear folks say that people are losing their Medicaid coverage, they're going to be off Medicaid. What you need to fill in the blanks on is how many people are off Medicaid and onto employer-provided health care. We just believe it's better if you're working for your family, for your community, and for yourself. And it's better if your employer is providing your health care, not your next-door neighbor. So it should be employer-provided health care if at all possible. The second piece of this is trying to be able to find ways to be able to stop this provider tax game that's gone on for years, where states like California will put a quote-unquote tax on their hospitals. They'll increase their amount that they're giving and pull down more federal funds out of the formula. Then they'll take that money and not spend it on healthcare.
This is really important.
Yeah.
This is what they do.
Yeah.
So they know they're going to get reimbursed. So what they do is they'll up the price so they get 90% reimbursement. Is that that would bring them more money?
Yep. So there's two aspects under Obamacare. Healthy adults that are just in this what's called the expansion population, they get 90% federal funding. Disabled children get 60% funding. We think that's wrong. We're not able to fix that in this bill, but we are. I'm telling you, we're going to continue to be able to work towards that to be able to get common agreement to say that disabled children should not get less of a percentage than healthy adults do in this. The second part of it is the provider tax piece. Let's say it's a 60-40 split where the federal taxpayer is paying 60% of it, the state's paying 40% of it. The state will then go to a hospital and they'll say, give us, you know, an additional chunk, millions of dollars from your hospital. They'll take that money. The state will contribute it, quote unquote, to their state match, get more federal dollars to be able to come down so it increases their percentage. And then the state will return that money right back to the hospital and the state will pocket the rest. So instead of maybe 60-40, it ends up being like 65-35. So the state's paying less. They're getting extra money that they're not due from the federal taxpayer. So states end up running a surplus of funding. They can do extra, and we continue to have a rising debt as Americans. So that's wrong for us to continue that process on it, and it's one of the areas we want to be able to fix.
So do you believe that you got to get past this bill if you can pass it? Do you think that because of this news cycle, it's very hard to explain it when you got these bombings, these raids, these everything that's going on? So I'm not sure it helps you in order, I think, to get something done. But I think a lot of people are going to say, what did we actually get?
The biggest piece that we're going to get on this is long-term deficit reduction. And I know the Washington, D.C. folks are saying, you know, this is going to cost trillions of dollars. What they mean by that is they want tax rates to go up on every American in January, and they think that that won't cause a contagion of problems in our economy. Right now, the tax rates are scheduled to all expire in January. Every single American, your tax rates will go up in January, and it will be a significant increase for every single American. We think that slows the economy down, and that causes all kinds of problems. So we're trying to protect our tax rates where they are now, the status quo, drop the rates for some working Americans, like no tax on tips and some of those things, the no tax on overtime piece, the try to reduce the tax burden for senior adults that are working senior adults getting Social Security, some of those targeted areas. But the biggest piece is don't cause tax rates to go up and find ways to be able to fix areas like Medicaid so we don't have this rising deficit problem.
It's going to be very interesting to see, because this is such a substantial bill, the results of which, the impact of which will make or break your midterm fortunes. And I know you think it will make fortunes.
We get the political side of it, but quite frankly, the fiscal part of it, long-term, and also the growth of the American economy, that's number one for us. What can we do to be able to help Americans right now to be able to pull out of this economy and to make sure that we get it to be a thriving, growing economy like it was during the end of the first Trump administration?
All right. He is Senator James Lankford. He's got his hands full, big agenda, but that's the way you like it. Senator, thanks so much.
You bet. We'll stay on and keep praying for the nation.
You got it. And by the way, the president's got a press conference today. He's going to push this bill. He's also going to have some tip workers with him to emphasize what this impact will do for people in the hospitality business or anybody that's any tipped worker out there. Don't move. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
It is time to take the quiz.
It's five questions in less than 5 minutes. We ask people on the streets of New York City to play along. Let's see how you do.
Take the quiz every day at thequiz.fox. Then come back here to see how you did.
Thank you for taking the quiz. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
They're both tired, exhausted. They fought very, very hard and very viciously, very violently. And they were both satisfied to go home and get out. And can it start again? I guess someday it can. It could maybe start soon. I think a big telltale sign was when, as you know, Iran somewhat, by not much, violated the ceasefire. And Israel had the planes going out that morning, and there were a lot of them, 52 of them. And I said, you got to get them back. And they brought them back. They didn't do anything.
So the President of the United States talked about how Iran and Israel were exhausted. And remember, whatever you think, and a lot of people wanted to see Israel finish the job. I remember the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post, the day before the ceasefire started, said, Benjamin Netanyahu said, we're very close to finishing our objectives and hitting all our targets in Israel, so in Iran. So it's telling. So just to finish up, the IDF lost 7 guys in Gaza 2 days ago. So the price is still being paid by men and women on the ground and in the air. What they're trying to do is reshape the Middle East from the worst day, October 7th, to possibly the brightest future. Here we are in June of 2025. Pretty amazing. And Israel has just done miraculous work. And we were there not only to arm them, advise them, but drop bombs when we needed to. Ayatollah Khomeini, after about 4 days of quietness, has come out and declared victory and said, I know where the U.S. are over in Iraq, and threatened, but it's pathetic. They have no air force. They lost their top scientists. They lost their top commanders. They lost their top intelligence officials. Countless assassinations. They were manhandled by a country a tenth of the size of them. President will understand, his negotiators will understand that they cannot allow, they'll be allowed to continue to finance their proxies. Gary in Daytona, Florida. Hey, Gary.
Hey, good morning, Brian. Hey, my take on the press conference this morning, especially from General Dan Raising Cane, was, and I watched it, watched it twice, actually, was I'm hoping that a lot of people, parents that have children between 20 and 30-something that are protesting Border Patrol and throwing things and on campuses tearing them up and rooting for Hamas, think about what he said with the 21 to 28 year olds and other service people in their 20s, probably doing such a great job.
Yeah, 21 to 28 did the operation. One of the lead intel analysts that was part of the mission had only been in the military 2 years. Others had worked on the bomb and the design and the attack since 2009. And just when you think, I always think, I have great respect for this generation of warfighters that fought for 20 years in Iraq and Afghanistan. They were let down by politicians, not by the way they fought and adjusted and the innovation on the battlefield. Just awesome. And then we see it again. And that's it. I think some people are watching. I think some 16-year-olds are watching that, maybe home from school today or done with school, and go, I think I'm joining. I mean, that's how impressive it was. And just to show you what you're capable of doing at 20, as you watch World War II, it's not just in the 1940s. It would be in 2025 if needed. All right, you'll listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Another great serviceman, Congressman John James, next.
Your gut affects everything, even your mood. So Ollie created 2 brand new products to take care of your insides. Ollie Big 10 Probiotic has 10 strains of probiotics, their most ever, to support a healthy gut microbiome, immune system, and stress response. And Ollie Super Good Superfoods delivers 15 superfoods in tasty gummy form. Find them at Ollie.com and exclusively at Walmart.
Ollie!
These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I can say here that the assessment is that we significantly damaged the nuclear program, setting it back by years. I repeat, years. The Iranian foreign minister, the spokesman, our nuclear installations have been badly damaged, that's for sure. I'm sure that's an understatement. John Ratcliffe, the director of the CIA, putting out a statement just last night. CIA can confirm that a body of credible intelligence indicates Iran's nuclear program has been severely damaged by recent targeted strikes. This includes new intelligence from a historically reliable, very different than preliminary assessment with low confidence. He's saying historically reliable and accurate source and method that several key Iranian nuclear facilities were destroyed and would have to be rebuilt over the course of years. CIA continues to collect additional reliably sourced information to keep appropriate decision makers fully informed.
So that was Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth in his 45-minute press conference explaining in detail, along with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, what exactly took place over the weekend that blew up three of the 12 nuclear sites inside Iran. I should tell you that the Grand Ayatollah spoke, and after 4 days of silence, people were speculating maybe he's out of power. He said, well, we won, and New York was acting silly, overstated what they'd done. Good luck. Nobody buys that Baghdad, Bob. And Ayatollah, at 86 years old, he's got to be absolutely humiliated when the doors close and he's sitting there only alone with his turban. Congressman John James joins us now, military veteran, Academy graduate, West Point, Energy and Commerce Committees now, thinking about running for governor. Congressman, welcome back.
Now, thanks for having me back on, Brian.
All right. So first off, what was your take on the press conference?
Well, I think it was where we should be getting our information, not from terrorists and not from communists. We should be getting our information from our intelligence personnel and from our leadership. And I don't think that they've folks out there have quite gotten the point. The point is a terrorist regime that must not have nuclear weapons capabilities and now knows that America is serious. They know that Donald Trump is as serious as a heart attack. And we've had presidents for decades say that Iran must not have a nuclear weapon. Well, we finally had a president step up and frankly send a very effective warning shot, sending Iran's nuclear ability to enrich weapons-grade uranium back a number of years. And the Iranians know we're serious. Just like you said, Brian, the Ayatollah has to save face. And when that door closes, he recognizes that he is short air defenses, he is short scientists, and he is short military leaders. And all he cares about is his power and destabilizing the region. I am a Iraq war veteran, and I understand what these extremists in Iran have done to American service members and what they've done to innocent civilians all over the Middle East. President Trump stepped up not just to keep America safe, but to make sure that we are respected from here on out.
But the one thing I will say is, so this initial report comes out, and it's from the Defense Intelligence Agency. It's one of our 17 branches. Mm-hmm. They came up with that assessment. They said, of low confidence, we don't believe that we set the programs back more than 2 to 3 months. But says, we got this from satellite video, and that's our assessment. Here's the problem, and you know this, is that that information got out. Why was it necessary to give that to a reporter? It doesn't help the country. Maybe it helps maybe sell some more copies of the Washington Post or CNN gets seven more viewers. But it's the same reporter that got it was the one with the Russian dossier. They said the laptop was real, that pushed the Russian hoax. So she puts her hand on the scale, this woman, and those people know what reporter will use the information that they leak. That's the problem. It's not what they came up with. They're a legitimate agency, but people in that agency are against the president.
I think this further underscores the depth of the swamp and pushing back on folks who will destabilize our own government for their own personal gain. That's why we are here fighting for the American people and making sure that we continue to maintain OPSEC, make sure that we continue to make sure that we're delivering for the American people. And folks know what we're up against here. We have an oath to the Constitution of the United States, and our number one priority is keeping Americans safe. And it's very difficult to do that when folks who call themselves journalists, who are nothing more than tabloid purveyors, are putting their own self aggrandation or their own self-benefit above the national security of the people. We're going to keep folks safe and just recognize that when they do this, they're putting American lives at risk.
So let me ask you, you still thinking about running for governor, right?
Oh, I'm in. I'm all the way in.
So Congressman, how do you be strong against Iran, be strong in the support Israel, and let the people in the Muslim community, the Arab community that makes up such a vital part of Michigan, know you're not against them?
No, of course not. See, this is the
but
thing.
Do they, they understand? Do they understand that when you talk to
yes,
them?
Yes. Look, we are one nation under God, indivisible. When we recognize that we all want the same things, we all want economic mobility. We all want academic excellence. We all want public safety. We all believe in the values of faith and family, God and country, and service before self. And those who are law-abiding citizens have a place in this America. People who are law-abiding citizens have a place in Michigan. We will absolutely defend that. We are a nation of immigrants, but we're also a nation of laws. And those who violate our laws will be held to account. Part of what's extremely important is securing our borders. Securing our northern border is super important. And I had the honor of welcoming Secretary Kristi Noem, our DHS secretary, up to our northern border in Detroit, Michigan, just last week, underscoring President Trump's commitment to keeping America safe. President Trump has kept his promises to keep America safe by securing our southern border and getting Mexico to pay for it, using leverage of tariffs to surge Mexican National Guard up to our southern border. He's keeping his promise to the American people, and we're going to make not just America safe again, but Michigan safe again by securing our border and making it home to anyone who is willing to be American.
The northern border is a real issue now because we understand they're starting to flow a lot of fentanyl through the northern border because they really shut down the southern border. Not many people thought that's possible. What about this? These sleeper cells have been the focus now of ICE, and they have now scooped up 130 Iranian nationals across the U.S. in the last 7 days. And ICE currently has 670 Iranians in ICE detention. That's a real worry. We were told October in the group of seven up in Canada when they met up there, they let Donald Trump know that there's a legitimate shot that these sleeper cells have been activated. Have you picked up that intelligence?
What we know is that there's been fentanyl and there's been human traffickers and drug traffickers flowing across our borders. Look, Canada has to do more. If they want to call themselves partners and allies, they have to do more to keep up their end of the bargain. Our northern border with Canada is the longest land border in the world. And these terrorists didn't just swim across the ocean. They didn't walk across the North Pole. They entered into Canadian ports of entry, into Canadian border points. And they were rubber stamped through their border control. And now they're threatening Americans. Well, our Canadian friends whom we share so much defense cooperation, so much economic cooperation, jobs on both sides of the border, now have to ante up and kick in because those who want to hurt and kill Americans are more committed to getting across our border than our partners in Canada are to securing it. And that's the wrong answer.
We need more
commitment and more dedication from our Canadian friends, or they can expect that we're going to be using every resource at our disposal to keep our people safe.
Today, the president's going to have a press conference to try to push the Senate to get a bill version back to the House and get it passed by the 4th of July. They've made some changes already. I'm sure you've seen some of this. Here's what Mark Wayne Mullen says you can expect in the House. Cut 39.
85% of the bill is what the House sent over. Now, the House and the White House and the Senate, we have been working very closely together to deliver a good bill. Even when the House was in the process of drawing theirs up, they were working with the Senate. So about 15% of it has changed, but that 15%, a lot of it was taken out through the bird vessel. Some of the sticking points is SALT, obviously, that we're still working through. What that is, state and local taxes. If you're not in a blue state, it's really not a big issue to you. And then some of the Medicaid and Medicare provisions where we're trying to cut the waste and fraud. Those are some sticking points that we're slowly working through the process to make sure we can deliver the votes in the House and in the Senate and put it on the president's desk.
He used to be in the House, too. So how do you feel about what is your state tax in Michigan?
Look, there's no way in heck that Michigan voters should be subsidizing Mom Donnie voters. People in across the country, around the coast, who are expecting to get their tax cuts on the backs of Michigan workers should expect that that frankly we need to get a better deal.
What's your state tax?
Their state tax right now, we're down around 21%. And so we need to make sure that we pass and make sure that we put more money back in the hands of people who earned it. Democrats are voting to take away tax on tips. Democrats are voting to make sure that they continue to tax your overtime.
Congressman, don't even talk about Democrats. It's all Republicans. Democrats have nothing to do with this. So,
well, they're not voting for it, Brian. Were you on the floor?
Oh, I know, but the thing is, but if Republicans got to get on board,
they are voting for.
But how do you get Republicans to vote for it? That's the point. Republicans, you have reconciliation. So in the House, what are you going to do when Mike Lawler says, I will not sign off on this unless I get my SALT deduction?
Well, you're going to have to talk to Mike Lawler. But right now, every single time that folks on the TV and on the radio say we're not going to get something done, we get it done. And I think that Speaker Johnson's leadership has really shown through in this. And I believe that President Trump's leadership has shown through in this. And we're going to deliver for the American people. And I'm going to do everything that I can to make sure that the folks in the state of Michigan benefit from this great, big, beautiful bill. See, we absolutely need this to make sure that we keep our economy stronger, that we bring jobs back to Michigan, that we put money back in the hands of people who've earned it. Because, frankly, we shouldn't be sending this cash to the coastal elite. We need to bring it right back home.
But let me ask you, Congressman, wouldn't people of Michigan benefit from a SALT deduction?
Well, certain people would benefit from a SALT deduction, but we're trying to make sure that everyone benefits the most from this. And if we're talking about holding up a bill for one specific provision when you're also increasing the deficit and the debt and then putting at jeopardy a larger bill, then I don't think that's fair to everybody. We need to get the most practical and the most conservative solution possible that will grow our economy, to bring our energy sector back, and they'll help bring jobs and investments back to places like Michigan.
No, listen, I'm in New York, and I'm with you. I don't think there should be a SALT deduction. That's a pay-for. You cannot reward high-tax states and give them a deduction because they never pay the price, and those taxes will continue to go up. And there's no reason why Florida, with more people, can have zero tax and move ahead of New York, by the way, with electoral votes. And New York has taxes get ratcheting up. And the clown that they just are about to nominate wants to up for people who are actually earning a living, he's going to up their taxes to give free buses, free food, faster buses, too, by the way. That's the problem. Buses aren't fast enough. Free food, free everything, if, of course, he's elected. That's what Democrats are becoming. What do you I think on if you were to tell them, they got to be panicked about what happened in New York yesterday.
It used to be that Democrats were the party of the working man. Now, Republicans are the party of the working man. And Democrats are the party of the non-working man. We're doing everything that we can to make sure that we're providing skilled trades opportunities, that we're putting money back in the hands of people who've earned it, that we're creating and helping folks create and pursue the American dream. But Democrats' policies, you can see the proof's in the pudding. Outflow of migration from high tax states going to low tax states. As we have population issues, I mean, people are going to where their talent and where their cash is treated with the most respect. Well, Republicans want to grow families because we want to put the money and the power back into your hands. And that's what we're going to be doing in Michigan. We're going to be focusing on the issues that help make you safer and help make you more prosperous, and not focusing on the coastal elites who, frankly, want to have their comfort on the backs of your effort.
Yeah, we'll see if Michigan can be the next Florida. Mike Rogers got very close to that Senate seat. You've gotten close before. Now let's see if the governor's mansion will go back to Republicans. Congressman John James, best of luck.
Thanks a lot, Brian.
All right, listen, I'm going to finish up with some calls. I can see you're fired up out there, especially if you saw that press conference today. 1-866-408-7669, Brian Kilmeade Show.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
There are some people who think climate change is a hoax. It ain't a hoax.
The reality is that the Earth's temperature has never been static. Scientists have captured the Earth's climate change over the last 485 million years. Here's a surprising place we stand now. So look at the far end of that graph, and you see we're in a cooling period.
Well, I'm not sure. No, I didn't read that article. But all I can tell you is that we are, in my view, going to see more extreme weather disturbances in the coming years than we have ever.
And that is great. I love Joe Rogan, former Democrat, likes Bernie Sanders, but he's just pushing the whole agenda. It's like first he comes out against Elon Musk. He's like, Elon Musk put 275, whatever it is, million in to Trump. He goes, well, how much did Kamala Harris get? 1.5 billion. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Too much money in politics specifically. Bernie Sanders says the same thing every time. And for some reason, he's got an audience, and it's sad. And a lot of them are young. which is bad, in my view. In fact, Bernie Sanders is now doing what other Republicans have done, and go on podcasts, long form. Why? Not so much you're trying to win people over, but if you show your personality in an hour podcast, or in Joe Rogan's case, a two-hour podcast, you can't really hide anything. Kamala Harris still couldn't show her personality. That's why they tried to keep her off everything except for that one podcast, Call Me Daddy. Pretty sure that was it. Wasn't it? Call Her Daddy?
It's right.
Call Her Daddy. That's better. Yeah, she was terrible on it. Terrible. Because she's not comfortable being herself. Bernie Sanders can be himself, but he's not going to win anybody over. Andrew Schultz said he's great. I love him to have him on. What does he say of interest? Zoe is so angry and hypocritical. I have three houses, and I fly around private, but the rich have it too good for too long. So, pretty amazing. And that's what's going on. Also, I got to salute the President of the United States. He came out yesterday. He could not believe it. Either can I. I don't go into details about what's going on with Israeli politics, but do you know that they're trying, putting Netanyahu, the current prime minister, on trial? On trial. They're still going after him over some menial thing about some type of fund or foundation. You're talking about a few $100,000 either way. It's clear lawfare. So President Trump put on Truth Social. He issued a fortified defense of him. He said he was shocked to learn that Netanyahu, fresh off what he called one of Israel's greatest moments in history, is being summoned to court. He, quote, Bibi and I just went through hell together, fighting a very tough, brilliant, longtime enemy of Israel, Iran. Bibi Netanyahu was a warrior, and the result was something that nobody thought was possible, a complete elimination of potentially one of the biggest and most powerful nuclear weapons anywhere in the U.S. The president condemned the ongoing prosecution of Netanyahu. It's gone viral. It's making a big deal. Also, some good news. Hamas looks, I think, good news. Who knows? They'll end up in Qatar, but Hamas says they want to talk. So the IDF, the Israelis will talk. They'll send a delegation. We'll play a role in that. And so will the Qataris. We'll see if they're done. We got 20-plus hostages still alive, 50-plus unaccounted for. Hezbollah was lost there. Another key commander in southern Lebanon. And this is one of these people that goes out to kill Israelis. He's dead, too. Hezbollah is still paying a price. Hamas is getting their head kicked in. I don't know who is left there, but maybe that's coming to an end, too.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. Mark Thiessen is standing by. Josh Krashauer is at the bottom of the hour to put all this in perspective. We've already seen an extraordinary Pentagon press conference this morning. Things are moving at a record speed in Trump world. We know that. 4 o'clock this afternoon, Donald Trump's going to talk about the big, beautiful bill. And, of course, there's a lot of action in New York City. Today, we have the current mayor relaunching his reelection campaign now as an independent, now that the Democratic primary is done. So before we get to Mark, who wrote about the primary, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
We're well on our way to getting this bill passed this week, which means we're well on our way to a stronger and more prosperous America.
Kinda. Senator John Thune, let's hope. Presidential push. Trump turning up the heat on his party. Holdouts standing in the way of passing his big, beautiful bill are going to be called out. Failure might not be an option, but it's still possible.
Number two.
The people who hate this result the most are the Democratic establishment. We have seen poll after poll after poll showing Democratic voters fed up with their leaders in Washington, fed up with their leaders in government.
Yes, that is true. That's a CNN pollster guy, thunderstruck. Governor Cuomo blows $25 million and loses the Democratic nomination for mayor against a New York radical Muslim socialist who hates Israel and probably hates Jews. Dems are more rattled than even Republicans.
Number one.
We're going to talk to them next week with Iran. We may sign an agreement. I don't know. To me, I don't think it's that necessary. I mean, they had a war. They fought. Now they're going back to their world. I don't care if I have an agreement or not.
The strike, the ceasefire, the intel. What's next? These are big questions we'll tackle as Israel and Iran are in a pause And it looks like Israel might be talking to Hamas, and Hezbollah loses another commander thanks to Israel's fantastic intelligence and execution. Mark Thiessen joins us now. He's not quite ready yet, but one thing was pretty clear. Pete Hegseth was ready today at this press conference. Right on time it started, and he railed right against the press. Here is the Secretary of Defense.
I can say here that the assessment is that we significantly damaged the nuclear program, setting it back by years. I repeat, years. The Iranian foreign minister, the spokesman, our nuclear installations have been badly damaged, that's for sure. I'm sure that's an understatement. John Ratcliffe, the director of the CIA, putting out a statement just last night. CIA can confirm that a body of credible intelligence indicates Iran's nuclear program has been severely damaged by recent targeted strikes. This includes new intelligence from a historically reliable, very different than preliminary assessment with low confidence. He's saying historically reliable and accurate source and method that several key Iranian nuclear facilities were destroyed and would have to be rebuilt over the course of years. CIA continues to collect additional reliably sourced information to keep appropriate decision makers fully informed.
That is the Secretary of Defense, and then he was sitting up there with the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Kane, who wanted to detail on how this preparation really started in 2009. They designed even the bunker busters with this Fordo plant in mind, with Natanz in mind. It was great detail, a lot of passion. In fact, General Kane said it reminded him of Donald Rumsfeld when he was Secretary of Defense. A man who worked for Rumsfeld joins us now, Mark Thiessen. Mark, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
What did you think of the press conference?
I thought it was great. I thought he made the case well. And look, the idea that we dropped 14 massive ordnance penetrators on these sites, which is the equivalent of 420,000 tons of TNT, 420,000 tons of TNT. That is a third of a 1.3 megaton bomb, nuclear bomb. And they set it back a couple months. Are you kidding me? It defies logic. I think this whole thing is just ridiculous. And we should, this is something that we should, as Americans, we should all be celebrating that we have dramatically set back the Iranian nuclear program. The fact is that this president is the only president who had the courage to actually act on the promise that every president before him, four presidents before him, had made and end this program. And God bless him for doing it.
So, The DIA came out and said it was preliminary. Other reports are coming out more specific. But all I can tell you is they went on their mission. They pulled off the mission. They hit all the sites they were supposed to. The execution was perfect. There was no turbulence on the way back. They weren't even detected on the way in. This is an overwhelming victory for the Israelis and for us. And right now, the Iranians are in the streets celebrating because the Ayatollah came out and said they won. I guess he's doing his best Baghdad Bob impersonation, but we have not seen the Grand Ayatollah. But on what planet did Iran come out? They're without an air force, their lead commanders, their generals.
No, there are no American planes in the skies over Tehran. There are no American planes.
So what happens now?
What happens now is we continue to monitor the situation. And look, Donald Trump just said at NATO, he doesn't need a nuclear deal with Iran now, right? We're not interested in negotiating with them. There's nothing to negotiate. Maybe if they want to sign like a surrender on the deck of the USS Missouri, he's happy to accept it. But he doesn't feel the need to go and negotiate because the program has been set back. And the reality is, if they start to reconstitute their program, we'll take it out again. You know, it's not like we're not aware. We don't have eyes over all of Iran. They have no air defenses, so Israel and the United States can fly spy missions over the skies of Tehran. If we want to zoom in on something, and we're a bit closer than a satellite, we can do that. And if they start to reconstitute it, we'll whack it again. You know, one of the things that Donald Trump has done, which I love, is that he has destroyed this principle of the Powell Doctrine, which is that if you break it, you own it, right? You can actually just break it, and you can break it over and over and over again. And the reality is we don't have to go into Iran. We don't have to send hundreds of thousands of troops into the country. We don't have to occupy it. We don't have to create a coalition provisional authority. We just need to whack their program anytime they stick their heads up. And that's what I'm confident, you know, once the taboo of attacking Iran is broken, mm-hmm. it's broken. Like, you know, why did Israel hesitate for so long in taking out the Iranian nuclear program? Because the danger was the Iran said they were going to send 1,000 missiles, which would have completely overwhelmed the Iron Dome. Hundreds of missiles would have landed. You know, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of Israelis would have died. And none of that happened, right? And so the whole myth, you know, the idea that Iran is this powerful country that can destroy Israel from the sky through its ballistic missiles has been destroyed. They're weak, and they can be they can do what they want. Both the United States and Israel can do what they want.
I know. The thing is, I want their surrogates starved of money. I don't want to. Sure. I want to make sure that people do not release or
no
countries
to lift sanctions.
Yep. So just continue to make sure, and I want that money followed. However, it's getting there. Those banks got to be suspended. We got to do. We're great at this when we want to be. Here's David Albright. He is the weapons inspector that said this is what his sources tell him about how much damage was done. Cut 16.
We've been looking at satellite imagery during the last 2 weeks, and it's a pretty devastating. I mean, a lot of their above ground facilities that are a critical part of a centrifuge program have been destroyed. So I think these reports that somehow there weren't centrifuges taken out are just incorrect.
Exactly. And you have to defy logic to do it. But the thing that's just bothered me, Mark, and I'll move on because we have so much more to talk about, is that the DIA was legitimate intelligence from the Department of the Defense Intelligence Agency. It was real. And that somehow someone thought they should give it to the press, the same reporter that caused all that turmoil with the dossier and all the Russia hoax stuff and the 51 intel agents and the laptop wasn't real. They knew exactly what reporter to get this story to. So the deep state still exists.
It very much does. And you know what? It's a useful reminder of what Donald Trump is dealing with internally, that there are people inside the government who want to stop him and want to thwart him and want to destroy him. And his enemies within the government exist and his enemies in the media exist, and they are collaborating to try and stop him. But you know what? It's so weak. It's so pathetic. It's not going to work.
So let's talk about domestic politics. In New York City, Governor Cuomo spent $25 million, had a 20-point lead, went down to 10, then went down to 5, and then he loses by about 100,000 votes in New York to the Democratic nomination to a person that says, I want to defund the police, I want to divest from Israel, who was a part of that Palestinian group. And when he was in college, he's just 33 years old. That's not too long ago. Wants to give free food out, make buses free and make them faster. Evidently, buses aren't hitting enough people and pedestrians. We have to pick up the pace a little. So this socialist extremist wins the Democratic primary on the back and fame endorsement of AOC, who is now a front runner for the Democratic nomination. There's got to be panic on the left, or am I wrong?
So I look at Cuomo versus Mamdani, I think that's how you say his name, and it actually relates back to the last conversation we have. Henry Kissinger was once asked, who are you rooting for in the Iran-Iraq war, and he said casualties. that's how I feel about Cuomo versus Mamdani. They're both the idea of either of them being in Gracie Mansion is atrocious. And as far as the voters in New York who chose him as the Democratic nominee, yes. I mean, I remember Ed Koch, who was one of the greatest mayors in New York history. He lost the Democratic primary to David Dinkins, and they said, "Mr. Mayor, will you ever run again?" And he said, "No, the people have spoken, and they must be punished."
That is a great line.
That's how I feel about the city of New York right now, my hometown, the place I grew up. You know, people have spoken, and they must be punished. I mean, you still got a chance to pick Eric Adams, who is the least worst candidate, to quote a Rumsfeldism, right? But he's no great shakes either. But if you guys elect this communist, pro-terrorist communist as your mayor, you deserve everything you get. And I think we should pick up Fox News and move to Miami.
Well, the prime minister, no, I hear you. Listen,
I'm
paying taxes. I'm paying taxes in New York City and I can't even vote. So, yeah. And they're going to run, if anyone who earns a living, they're going to up your taxes. So people who don't can get more, and illegal aliens can be treated equally. And also he says if the Prime Minister Netanyahu comes to the United Nations or comes to New York, he will arrest him, even though.
Good luck.
I hear you. Here's Mike Lawler, who might run for governor because he, like many people, saw how much ground Donald Trump made up in New York. He increased his popularity in New York more than any other state. Here's what Lawler said about what this primary showed him. Cut 32.
Frankly, I thought Ron DeSantis might as well have funded Zohran's campaign because it's the best gift to Florida. You're going to continue to see businesses and population leaving New York with an avowed socialist running at the helm. And Chuck Schumer, Hakeem Jeffries, and Kathy
Hochul
are going to meet with him.
Yeah.
And do what?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to tell him that you oppose these policies? No, because they're petrified of the far left. And Schumer's petrified of a primary challenge by AOC in 2028.
They're in a tough spot. My heart goes out to them.
You know, I look at all of this. I look at the rise of Zohran. I look at AOC possibly challenging Schumer in the Senate. I look at Jasmine Crockett as being the new face, and I sort of say, give me more cowbell. You know,
yeah.
This is the best thing that ever happened to the Republican Party. It's a bad thing for the country because we actually do need two political parties that are sane. And it's really bad that there's no sane Democratic Party. It's great for Republican politics, but the problem becomes is that even as bad as the Democrats are, the pendulum swings, right? And they're going to get elected. I mean, we just saw Joe Biden was elected president for 4 years and the absolute disaster he was. And now imagine going further left than that, where they're as incompetent as Biden without the senility as an excuse. It's bad for the country that we have a Democratic Party like this, but it's great for a Republican election.
I'm just going to look at President Trump for a second. I think in NATO, there's no doubt about it. It's a huge victory. How do I know? Because no one's talking about it on the other channels. Number two, he comes back with a huge victory as of right now, as Iran is no longer a nuclear nation. That's a huge victory. Israel has done phenomenal work, historic, showing themselves to be the lethal force they are, as we do. And then he comes back home. He wants to get the economy going. The big, beautiful bill is a week away, I think, from passing. And now I'm watching the German leader, the new chancellor, say, I want this deal done, trade deal done with the EU and U.S. I don't like the pace of it. I want this done quickly. Now, if you can get an EU deal, Japan deal, India deal, start pulling them in over the summer, this starts kicking into place and permanent tax cuts allow people to budget and invest, or not invest, whatever they decide to do, but plan long term. This could really, the one, he's struggling a little on the economy right now. You do this, and man, there's going to be a lot of optimism amongst Republicans, legitimate reason for optimism.
So he's already in less than 6 months in, he's the greatest foreign policy president since Ronald Reagan in terms of what he's accomplished between NATO and the Iran and destroying the Iran nuclear program. And if he is able to get these trade deals, I think he'll go down as the greatest free trade president in history. Because if he the threat of tariffs brings all of these countries to the table and negotiates trade deals, and then he passes the bill that makes his tax cuts permanent and delivers on his promises to working class Americans, he's going to be the greatest economic president since Ronald Reagan. He's on the cusp of greatness
right
now.
Let's see if his party's going to give him the bill.
They're going to give him the bill. They're going to give him the bill. Try it. They'd be the last holdout, the one vote trying to destroy the Trump presidency. Right. I dare you.
I hear you. Mark Thiessen, thanks so much, Mark. Doing great work.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Take care.
1-866-408-7669.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
You're running on issues that are very relevant to people in New York City, the cost of housing, free busing. Some have projected, that this is the type of platform that would work in other parts of the country. I mean, you're a proud Democratic socialist. Do you think that is a platform that would work for other candidates running in other parts of the country?
Absolutely. I think ultimately this is a campaign about inequality. And you don't have to live in the most expensive city in the country to have experienced that inequality because it's a national issue. And what Americans coast to coast are looking for are people who will fight for them, not just believe in the things that resonate with their lives, but actually fight and deliver on those very things. And part of how we got to this point was through the endorsements of Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Bernie Sanders, who've been leading this fight against oligarchy across the country. And I think that in focusing on working people and their struggles, we also return back to what makes so many of us proud to be Democrats in the first place.
Yeah, that is Mamdani's talking to Jen Psaki last night. Laura Gillen, Democrat from New York, who flipped a Republican seat, says sharply criticized him. She said, "I'm deeply disturbing pattern of unacceptable anti-Semitic comments. No endorsement from them. No endorsement from Jeffries. No endorsement from Schumer. They can't figure it out." Rick in Pennsylvania. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Brian. This media is awful. You know, a few years ago, there was a book called Unfreedom of the Press that was written by Mark Levin, and he spells it out perfectly. This media, you know, they go on and on and on about how the nuclear facilities were never destroyed and all this stuff.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We're going to talk to them next week with Iran. We may sign an agreement. I don't know. To me, I don't think it's that necessary. I mean, they had a war. They fought. Now they're going back to their world. I don't care if I have an agreement or not. The only thing we'd be asking for is what we were asking for before about we want no nuclear, but we destroyed the nuclear. In other words, it's destroyed. I said, Iran will not have nuclear. Well, we blew it up. It's blown up to kingdom come. And so I don't feel very strongly about it. If we got a document, wouldn't be bad. We're going to meet with them, actually. We're going to meet with them.
They'll meet next week. I don't know what they're going to talk about, but it has to be forget about sanctions relief until you pledge and actually prove no more funding of your proxies, because Hezbollah and Hamas have destroyed the region. They took Lebanon from Lebanon. Now Lebanon's back. I don't know what's going to be next in Hamas, but I don't want money flowing from Iran. My sense it hasn't been, because just out of necessity. And the Houthi rebels would not exist without Iran. Josh Krashtauer joins us now, Fox News Radio political analyst, editor-in-chief of the Jewish Insider. His latest story is pro-Israel groups applaud U.S. strikes in Iran while the Democrats just stay silent or are against it, or say things like Senator Kelly, oh, now there's no plan, there's just chaos. Josh, were you for, do you think this was a good move to take out their nuclear sites?
Well, I look at the reaction in the aftermath, and a threat that was been warned about by presidents, many of them from other parties, Democrats, Republicans, from dating back to Bill Clinton, now to Donald Trump. And Trump was the only president who had the stones, really, to actually execute on the rhetoric and live up to preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, which was a threat clearly to Israel, but also to global security and to the United States of America. So, look, I'm going to be interested to see the polling now that we know Iran essentially surrendered and wanted a ceasefire, and Trump sort of executed on this peace through strength, very Reagan-esque strategy. I think there was a lot of wariness. If you look at the polling in the beginning, I think you always hear the voices of what is this going to lead to? Could there be a wider war? I think this was well thought through by the Trump administration, by the national security officials, well executed. We heard from the Pentagon, you know, this morning, laying out the planning and detail that went into the attack. And the results seem to be quite positive. So I'm going to be interested in looking at the polling in a few days. I think we're already seeing some movement in support for what Trump did, and to the peace that it made. Peace is a strong word, but I think the cessation of threats and terrorism and hostility that this could lead to, at least in the medium term. And look, when you talk, there's this big debate about intelligence and what actually was transpired at these three big nuclear sites. I mean, if you talk to the Israelis, if you talk to the people closest to the ground, talk to the nuclear experts, they think this was a very significant hit that rolled back Iranian nuclear capabilities for quite some time.
See, the Ayatollah came out and said they won. And I'm watching some footage on the streets of Tehran where the Quds Force commanders, the ones that are still alive, are acting like they're heroes. But it's also pointed out that Saddam Hussein was in Baghdad walking around 15 minutes before Baghdad fell. So I'm not saying the Ayatollah, I mean, for the Ayatollah to try to sell a population that's supposed to be as well-educated as they are, that they won, I've hard to believe that they're going to be that naive.
Well, yeah, it was interesting actually that I think it was a spokesman for the diplomatic ministry in Iran actually said that our nuclear materials were severely damaged, and then we didn't hear from the Ayatollah. He was, you know, radio silent until today. That's the kind of bluster we're used to hearing from the Ayatollah and the IRGC. I don't think it means a whole lot. Clearly, their operational threats have been severely degraded, both in terms of their proxies and now with the Trump administration's decision to strike these deep facilities at Fordo and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. I can tell you from the Israeli national security sense is that this was a big success and accomplished a longstanding goal.
Here's our Secretary of State, cut five.
President Trump has shown a willingness to meet and talk to anybody in the world who's interested in peace. I don't know of any president that's been as willing as he has to meet with anyone and talk about peace. We'd love to have peaceful relations with any country in the world. And so obviously that'll depend on Iran's willingness not just to engage in peace, but to negotiate directly with the United States, not through some third country or fourth country process. But I know of no president probably in our modern history that's sought peace more than President Trump has.
Is he right?
Well, look, I don't think the Iranians, even with their degraded capabilities, want peace. They are going to want to continue to do whatever they can do to cause, you know, chaos and misery. But the good news is that their ability to do that in the wake of Israel's military operations dating back to after October 7th and the American strikes last weekend make it they're in a much weakened state, so they can talk a big game, but they can't really do the types of things that they wanted to do. I think it's as important as ever, even if we're going to have diplomatic talks with the Iranians apparently next week. You know, their worldview has not changed. It's a revolutionary worldview that stems back to 1979. And you listen to the Ayatollah, you listen to the IRGC, these hardened military allies of the Ayatollah, and this is the same type of extremist rhetoric we're going to hear, and it's not going to change. Now, there may be some tactical agreements like that could be reached in the aftermath of the military victory, but I don't think you're ever going to see an Iranian regime under this revolutionary regime that's ever going to want actual peace.
Neither do I. What are you hearing about Hamas and Israeli talks over in Qatar?
Hamas has been badly degraded. They have been for some time. Gaza is, you know, largely like destroyed, and so that they're very weakened. I do think I have heard, and there's some reporting, that Trump is looking to, I think there's a sentiment in Israel too that. You know, this is a nice opportunity to kind of close a chapter on war and maybe build alliances and diplomacy and expand on the Abraham Accords to Arab nations in the region. Now that Iran is a shadow of its former self, and if you can kind of come up with a release the hostages, get Hamas leaders exiled, and try to rebuild the territory, that would be a good capstone on what just happened this month. I don't know if we're there yet. Bibi has been kind of. I mean, I think the Trump administration has been. Suggesting, at least to the Israelis, that it would be very a good plan to kind of try to put an end to the war and reach some agreement. But we don't know what Hamas is asking for, and there are a lot of devils in the details. So it does seem like it's an opportunity, given what happened, and given that Hamas's proxy has been degraded, and given that they've been degraded over the last 18 months. But we don't know exactly where those talks are going
to
be headed.
I want you to hear this exchange. I think the president's really starting to get fed up with Vladimir Putin. I know, finally, but says it. He said yesterday clearly that Vladimir Putin's the problem. He is extremely tough to deal with. And he didn't say equal to try to balance it out. Here's what he said. I thought he had an interesting exchange with this Ukrainian reporter, cut 19.
So my question to you is whether or not the U.S. is ready to sell anti-air missile systems Patriot to Ukraine.
We know. Are you living yourself now in Ukraine?
My husband is there.
Wow. And I can see you're very, you know, it's amazing.
And me with the kids, I'm in Warsaw, actually, because he wanted me to
be. Is your husband a soldier? No?
He's
there now?
Yeah.
Wow. That's rough stuff, right? That's tough. And you're living here?
In Warsaw.
And you're a reporter?
I am.
Good. So let me just tell you, they do want to have the anti-missile missiles, okay, as they call them. We're going to see if we can make some available, you know?
And what he said there is Megan Bell, Patriots. And Zelensky asked him personally at Patriots. And he just had, I thought, a very human exchange there.
Oh, it was quite a moment yesterday at the NATO summit. And I think you could see the policy change or shift, perhaps, as Trump had been talking to European leaders, but also listening to kind of the on-the-ground voices in Europe. I mean, first, number one, the European countries, with a few exceptions, are now committing to spend about 5% of their budget on defense, which has been a longstanding Trump priority. And it may have opened up the possibility for Trump to actually, we'll see. I think that's the big test to come, but whether this administration is now going to send more defense and offensive military capabilities to Ukraine, because that's starting to dry up a little bit, at least on the U.S. side. And it's a very important pivot point when it comes to the U.S. support for Ukraine and the ability to defeat Russia and deter Russia. So that's going to be the big question on the policy front. But it did seem like Trump's views have been shifting a little bit. I also think the incredible defeat, the Israeli and U.S. defeat of Iran, when a lot of people that are in the, you know, the Trump inner circle had cautioned about the worst case scenarios that are more on the isolationist side, a lot of their predictions did not even come close to bearing themselves out. And a lot of the people, I think Secretary of State Rubio is a key voice in kind of striking a middle ground. And he's certainly been a hawk on and a defender of Ukraine throughout his political career. I think those are the voices that are having more credibility now in Trump's circle. So I think it certainly applied when it came to the Middle East and the success in degrading Iran's nuclear capabilities and working with Israel to do so. And I think, you know, you can extend that to looking at how helping Ukraine can help deter and defeat Russia in the European front. So I think that's a big piece of the puzzle. It was encouraging to hear Trump's comments yesterday, but there's still a long way to go.
Absolutely. Josh, it's going to be very interesting. Do you hear any Democrats coming out in support of this?
The thing about the Democratic, right, you referred to the story we wrote, where they just kind of put their finger in the wind and were trying to root against the mission. And, you know, I think the problem with making political decisions on the short term is that events can quickly, you know, push you behind. And the fact that this operation is a pretty, unequivocal success is going to change the politics. And I don't think you're going to hear Democrats attacking the decision come the midterm elections.
Yeah, I think they'll try to bury it because right now it looks like the absolute right decision that five presidents passed on, because this thing has been in the works since 2009. If you watch the briefing today, Josh Krashauer, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, listen, we're going to come back. I'm going to have some time before we finish up the hour. 1-866-408-7669. I know it's not the sexiest topic, but the big, beautiful bill could decide the midterm elections. What's in it? What are the holdups? And what are we going to see today at 4 o'clock? Don't move.
Want even more, Brian? Download the podcast at BrianKilmeadShow.com. Every episode, exclusive interviews on demand. More of Kilmeade coming up. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
You know, they fight like hell. You can't stop them. Let them fight for about 2-3 minutes. Then it's easy to stop them.
Now, Daddy has to sometimes use strong language.
Strong language. Every once in a while, you have to use a certain word.
Deborah Haynes from Sky News. Mark Rutte, the NATO chief, who is your friend, he called you Daddy earlier. Do you regard your NATO allies as kind of children?
No, he likes me. I think he likes me. If he doesn't, I'll let you know. I'll come back and I'll hit him hard, okay? No.
But
He did it very affectionately. He, Daddy, you're my daddy.
It was just such an odd exchange because they were just doing the analogy of kids punching themselves out when you talk about when you talk about Ukraine and Russia. And then people have pointed out that it was kind of funny for that question to come up, but then you see Marco Rubio laugh hysterically in the back. It provided a little bit of a comic relief, but it also reminded people of what a very similar situation were, also very inappropriate, when they just were begging for Joe Biden to come out and do a press conference, and KJP talked in this way about the quest to get him to come out and answer questions because she couldn't answer anything ever. Cut 22.
Two questions. One's just a logistical one, which is, you mentioned the press conference.
Yeah.
Is that going to be kind of the real big boy press conference that we're used to?
Big boy press conference.
You know, like one of these two and twos that might be a little more limited.
So I believe, and I know you guys are holding me to it, I believe it's a solo press conference. We'll certainly have more to share with all of you as we get closer.
So that was in. Kirby came on a little bit later, cut 23.
President Biden will speak to national labor leaders of AFL-CIO, host the NATO summit to show the unprecedented strength of our alliance, hold a press conference, a big boy press conference, according to Justin Sink from Bloomberg.
After that, the president will hold a press conference. I guess a big boy press conference is what we're calling it. Yeah, I will let Corrine talk about the press conference, the big boy press conference that y'all are planning to have.
And you'll certainly hear from the president on Thursday when he gives his press conference, his big boy press conference, as your colleague Justin has stated many times.
Unbelievable. And he never did, by the way. He's always was terrible. When you see the president speak four or five times a day, go to these conferences, speak candidly, you realize how much more interesting your job is when people talk to you. It doesn't seem like many in the media are appreciative of that. Maybe they like the idea of never getting news out of the White House. Hank in Virginia. Hey, Hank.
Hey, buddy. Hey, Brian. How you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, here's the thing. I was hoping that the United States could expedite the mining of the rare earths in Ukraine. And it kind of put Putin on notice. And, you know, if we could just get that thing moving, I don't think Putin's going to want to kill Americans.
Well, I like to get it for us. I don't know if that would be really dissuade him. I would like to see our guys over there. But let me ask you, if you were a private contractor working in the mines, would you want to say, hey, I'm going to go to Ukraine for a while? It's the most violent place on earth right now. So I think it's a deal that shows that we are investing in their future and their country's not going to be overrun. But I also think we just in the short term, Hank, just get them the weapons to continue to make Russia pay the price because they will not quit. Currently, they're willing to just continue to fight it out. And I think Trump has got to just say, you got 2 weeks working at a ceasefire and building towards a peace, or we're putting on massive sanctions and we're going to start repurposing the $300 billion that is just laying in Western banks and giving it to Ukraine in order to get them the weapons they need. In order to fight you and kill your guys. Until that happens, this thing is just going to drag on. And I don't really think that right now you could say that Iran has been lost. A pathway to arm the Houthis is gone thanks to Syria. They've lost a port thanks to Syria. They're kicking him out of that country. Iran was expediting the Shahed drones. That was going through Syria. Now it's going to be a tougher trek. And I don't really think they're going to be giving weapons to anyone for a while because of the way Israel just eviscerated them, killed all their commanders. I mean, they're going to have a Christmas party next year. They're going to need name tags. They're not going to know who it is. So, yeah, the Ukraine situation is interesting. I think they're going to have a fit. That's going to be, if they could keep this as a ceasefire, if they get the hostages out of Hamas and then focus on Ukraine again, I think the pressure on Putin will be enormous, especially if they could find a way to leverage China on the trade deal. Say, can you stop supplying these guys? I know you're denying it, but the dual-use weapons and the flat-out money you're giving them and the oil that you're buying is financing the death and destruction. And by the way, China never had a bad relationship with Ukraine. They've never had a bad... Russia didn't have a bad relationship with Israel. But now they ended up arming Hezbollah. Those weapons turned up in Gaza, Russian weapons. And then you see China arming Russia. Ukraine's not going to forget that. So they made a few bad moves. I understand why they got to arm Russia in the beginning. But they made a few really disturbing moves. But we do know, too, I think that President Trump sat down with Zelensky yesterday, who I guess it bothers the president that he doesn't dress in a suit. So he dressed in a suit. And I think they made some progress. But we're having problems now with something that they need, patriots. He said, I gave a whole bunch of patriots to the Israelis. You know, the Western countries are buying patriots. We got patriot missiles around our bases. We had to repurpose some of the items that we're going to. Some of the GPS and some of the inner workings of the patriot missile system had to be repurposed and sent over to the Middle East. I guess it was pretty clear that Trump was going to take his shot. And Pete Hegseth said, we're not quite ready there. So that was diverted. But if things settle down in Israel, then a lot of that, the Western hardware, the military hardware, will go that direction towards Ukraine again.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being here. Brian Kilmeade Show. We come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. And, of course, everybody's talking about the big mayoral primary yesterday that put Andrew Cuomo into retirement. He said, I'm not going to run as an independent. So that's going to be pretty big because he was going to run like that. Eric Adams, who they thought was dead in the water, I think he's got a legitimate shot now. Curtis Sliwa, they say Governor Pataki did some work, said they he got 28% of the vote. And all the Democrats stay in, he might have an avenue to success. Olivia Rheingold's here, staff writer for the Free Press. And before we get to her, let's get to the big three stories you need to know.
Number three.
We're well on our way to getting this bill passed this week, which means we're well on our way to a stronger and more prosperous America.
Yes, that is Senator John Thune. July 4th is the deadline. He wants the Senate to agree on a deal. It's 85% of what the House gave him. Then the House has got to sign off on it, which will be tough. And then we'll see if we can get this by Independence Day.
Number two.
The people who hate this result the most are the Democratic establishment. We have seen poll after poll after poll showing Democratic voters fed up with their leaders in Washington, fed up with their leaders in government.
And that is CNN's pollster, Thunderstruck. Governor Cuomo blows $25 million and loses the Democratic nomination for mayor, while a radical socialist Muslim, 33 years old, Zohran Mamdani, wins it. The Dems are more rattled, in my view, than even Republicans.
Number one.
We're going to talk to them next week with Iran. We may sign an agreement. I don't know. To me, I don't think it's that necessary. I mean, they had a war. They fought. Now they're going back to their world. I don't care if I have an agreement or not.
I think we should care. And you got to make sure they don't finance their proxies. That is the President of the United States. The strike, the ceasefire, the intel. What's next? There are big questions we will tackle throughout the hour. But first thing first, Olivia, you've been covering this local election that's got national attention. When did you realize that Mamdani had a shot?
I can't think of an exact watershed moment. I guess I would explain it more as a trickle. I think perhaps it's my age group. I just noticed people I knew were sharing, were following his content way before that support was registering in the poll numbers. I mean, when we started covering this at the Free Press, he was polling at 1%, but I just had the sense that there was a lot of support that was not yet registering.
You said that he has 50,000 followers. Excuse me, 50,000 volunteers.
Oh, volunteers. Yeah, because followers, they've been shooting up overnight. He gained almost 600,000 Instagram followers overnight.
So you think social media, he's been strong. I saw that he jumped in the ocean during the polar plunge with his suit on. He's doing a lot of videos. So he's great on social media, much like AOC.
Yeah. But I would say it goes beyond that. I mean, you mentioned he had an army of 50,000 volunteers. The Cuomo campaign, I am so sorry to say it, a lot of the staffers that they, or the canvassers they ultimately hired, they were paid. There was not a lot of unpaid support. This is 50,000 people spending weekends, rain or shine. I mean, I went to some of these events and you kind of get the sense that people are there because it's fun, because they're there to meet people. The night of the election, by my estimation, there were probably 15 parties in bars across the city, young people getting drunk, you know, rolling joints, having the time of their life, chanting, Zohran, Zohran, Zohran.
But what do they like about him?
What do they like about him?
Because, I mean, he's for free buses. He's for free supermarkets.
Right.
He's for free housing. He's for raising taxes.
What
about this? Cut third 25.
Would a mayor Mamdani welcome Benjamin Netanyahu to the city?
No. As mayor, New York City would arrest Benjamin Netanyahu. This is a city that our values are in line with international law. It's time that our actions are also.
So there he is.
Yeah.
He also is known as being anti-Semitic. Certainly anti-Israel, wants to divest from it. What is... He is, and he's a proud socialist.
Right. And just to be clear, in case listeners didn't understand what he was saying in that clip, that is him declaring his intent to possibly arrest Benjamin Netanyahu were he to step foot in New York City. And to the supporters of Zohran, that is not a negative. That is a positive. They consider that justice in action because things are that backwards right now. So what do they like about him? I would say they consider him a progressive champion. Of course, the irony is that when you look at his base of support, it's people making over $100,000. A lot of the voters who went towards Cuomo were minorities, were working class.
He didn't get the black vote.
Right.
So
right.
So Cuomo got the black vote, yeah, and lost New York. Unbelievable. Now, look, I think that this guy is, he's disgraced. And he's lazy.
Cuomo.
And I think he thought that the whole mayor stuff was beneath him. He didn't even know. He's trying to reclaim his career, but he didn't even want the job.
I don't know. I have heard that talking point. Like, I listened or watched Morning Joe the day after the election. And
that hurts my feelings, by the way.
You know, you got to see what they're saying. And it was very similar to election the morning after Kamala's loss, where they were saying, oh, Kamala, you know, we only had however long we had. She didn't get out there enough. And I heard a lot of the same talking points about Cuomo saying he wasn't having enough events. And listen, if it wasn't about that at all, the votes, they were not against Cuomo. They were for Zoe Ron. I think if Cuomo were to have any more or less events, it wouldn't have made a difference.
So interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I want you to hear what Eric Adams told us, because you were watching Morning Joe.
Yeah,
we had Eric
yeah.
Adams on our show.
Okay.
Cut 26.
He's a snake oil salesman. Mm-hmm. He will say and do anything to get elected. Think about this for a moment. He wants to raise 1%. He wants to raise tax on 1% of New York's high income earners. As the mayor, you don't have the authority to do that. You know who has the authority to do that? An assemblyman, which he is. He wants to do free buses. He could have done it at assemblyman. He doesn't understand the power of government and how you must make sure you improve your economy, raise the standard of living. And this is what we've done in the city. And I'm looking forward to being on the campaign trail and showing New Yorkers we can't go backwards. And New Yorkers never surrender or quit.
Well, he says he doesn't want to go backwards, but he does say that you point out in your column that if he wants to give one of these things, I think he wants to give her a food or a free bus, it's going to be $100 billion.
That's his housing plan.
That is
his housing plan. I would say, so I guess there you're trying to get at the general, because obviously Eric Adams, the big matchup now is Zoe Ron has won the Democratic nomination, and so he's going to go up against Eric Adams.
Yeah.
And the problem, I think, politically with the clip you just played is that what Eric Adams is essentially trying to do is say, Zoe Ron is not a serious guy. He's not a serious contender. I'm serious. I understand how to govern. And I don't know, A, that Zoe Ron supporters care. And I don't know how credible that is in the eyes of New Yorkers coming from Eric Adams. The problem is that
damaged is he?
Eric Adams.
Because, you know, the indictments, yeah, taking his phone, the FBI, I don't think people really caught Turkish embassy.
Right, right.
You know, what's going on?
Yeah. I would say there's probably a split. I would say, and a split that arguably works in his favor in the general election, because I think that the base of his support, really minorities, the black community, you know, upper Manhattan, the Bronx, whatever, I don't think that they are as bothered by this stuff. And Zoe Ron's base is obviously quite bothered. So he mm-hmm. kind of breaks even there, I guess.
So Olivia Rheingold's with us from the Free Press, staff writer there. How does he feel about the Free Press?
Oh, Zoe Ron? Oh, my goodness.
Does he like you? Does he like talking to you?
He runs from me like the plague, like literally has run from me. No, I haven't. I call them almost every day now, just leave voicemails saying, hey, checking in. It's Olivia Rheingold from the Free
Press.
What's
he afraid of? That's not Trumpian.
Think he doesn't want scrutiny on the Israel stuff. I think, and to be honest, I think he considers these very fair questions about how he distinguishes anti-Semitism from anti-Zionism. I think he considers them nonsense, when really I think he has an obligation to New Yorkers, especially Jewish voters, to answer those questions.
Don't we have more Jewish voters in New York City than anywhere except Israel?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Jewish residents overall.
Why would any Jewish person vote for this guy? He wants to divest from Israel. Do you know what he did in college?
Of course.
Well,
of course.
He was involved with these Palestinian organizations.
Yeah, he started the student chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine at Bowdoin, a college that now costs about $100,000 a year to attend.
His family's rich.
Oh, yeah. His father is, I think you could say, a giant in the field of anti-Zionist studies. He's a professor at Columbia University.
Unbelievable. I did not know that. Here's Curtis Sliwa, who thinks he's got a real shot now, and I hope so. Cut 28.
Today, homeless people, emotionally disturbed, garbage everywhere, the quality of life miserable. One of the outtakes of the election is people were complaining about the lack of affordable housing, the fact that the cost of living is skyrocketing, and the crime in New York City. We lock up toothpaste in a drugstore, and we don't lock up criminals. People have had enough. We don't want to go back to these Democrats. And, Sean, you know me for 46 years. I am the consummate New Yorker. I haven't fled or moved or gone anywhere else. I was birthed here in New York City, and my whole campaign is based on improve, don't move.
So he did better than a lot of people thought last time. So what do you think? You saw the Pataki story that he said there was a pathway, right?
No, I didn't.
You said there was, if you get 20, if Cuomo stayed in and Adams stayed in, and so Mondani won, he said that there would be a pathway at 28% would give him the victory.
I understand that because obviously the moderate vote would be split there. I mean, Curtis Sliwa, listen, I liked that bite you just played, but he's got to get over the reputation. I think he's got a really kind of reputation as like a zany cat man.
Yeah.
That I think he's, in order to really capture that moderate energy and like an anti-Zohran coalition, he's got to be seen more seriously.
So don't wear the Guardian Angel stuff.
I mean, the red beret, it is kind of chic. It is kind of chic, but more bites like whatever you just played.
You like that?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think that could work.
All right, we'll see what happens. So this is what Mike Lawler said, the Republican who might be running for governor because Donald Trump made so much progress in New York, is giving Republicans hopes that they might be able to take a major seat. And he also says that AOC will actually benefit from this after her endorsement. There's a lot of people giving her credit for that. Cut 31.
And he's petrified of AOC, and she had probably the best night out of Zohran Mamdani because she endorsed him, and she helped propel him into office back in 2020 when he flipped a Democratic seat, defeating a Democrat incumbent. And ultimately, you have seen this rise within New York City of avowed socialism. They openly talk about defunding the police, not cooperating with ICE agents. Free everything, free grocery stores, free busing and mass transit, free food, clothing, health care, housing for illegal immigrants. And you see the consequences of that. Wall Street has been leaving New York in droves. They're going to Palm Beach. They're going to Dallas. They're going to Atlanta.
And they're going to keep going if this happens.
Right. Well, OK, so at the top of that clip,
he was
talking about the power of AOC's endorsement. Yeah. I just want to add, before this started, we were talking about Eric Adams and whether or not he had a shot. OK, why Zohran is going to be so hard to take down is it's not just AOC. It's not just Bernie Sanders, who also endorsed him. It's not just Hassan Piker, who has spoken positively about 9/11. And Hassan Piker, by the way, is beloved. He has a massive fan base. It's not just those endorsements. It's every single influencer across the city. It's makeup reviewers, skateboarders, baristas, like an insane coalition of everyday New Yorkers, and these influencers that really matter to Gen Z and millennials has endorsed Zohran.
So what about the first one you mentioned that is tossed positively, like 9/11 was a good day?
Hassan Piker. Have you heard of him?
No.
By the way, oh my gosh, he's gigantic. He is, I believe, the biggest Twitch streamer. And Twitch is a platform that most people associate with gaming, but actually political content can be just as popular. And he is, I mean, I think he identifies as a socialist. I'm not sure if socialist is the strong enough term there. Extremely, like, radically anti-Israel.
And that his endorsement
Yeah.
Furthers anyone who's worried about being he's anti-Semitic will just back that up.
Right. And they created content together. You know, there are photos of them. Zohran sat down for about an hour long interview that was extremely chummy.
Wow. I'll keep my eye on that. And Olivia, I guess if the young people will decide this election, he looks like he's in a good spot and you are predicting he will win.
I feel like, I guess it's too early. Just based on looking at the showdown that has emerged between Zohran and Eric Adams so far, and then Curtis Lewa, I don't think those guys are going to be able to stop this.
We'll see. Olivia, I'll talk to you along the way. Pick up the free press. And please, if you're Zohran, please talk to Olivia.
Please.
She's calling you
call
every
me back.
Day.
Call me
back.
Back
in a moment.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I thought it was important. They thought it was important at the Pentagon to clarify what exactly happened with these historic blasts and bombings that took place in Iran. Ayatollah speaking now said he won the war. That's very no one buys that. I'm sure he doesn't. I know his people don't. But that's why the Pentagon called a press conference at 8 o'clock in the morning to go into detail and talk about the planning and the men and women that pulled off the bombing all in their 20s, the people that have been working on this whole operation, looking at Fordo, looking at Natanz, have been doing simulations since 2009. Listen to this, General Kane.
The primary kill mechanism in the mission space was a mix of overpressure and blast ripping through the open tunnels and destroying critical hardware. The majority of the damage we assessed based on our extensive modeling was a blast layer combined with the impulse extending from the shock. Imagine what this looks like six times over.
So he was just talking about how the intricacies of how the bomb followed the bomb, followed the bomb, and followed the blew up. Now, we're seeing all these reports that damage was done. I'm seeing another report, Jerusalem Post, not as much as they thought. It doesn't matter. The precedent has been set. They start reconstituting. We hear about them digging into a mountain. We're going to see it all from above. We're going to act. You know who else is going to act? Israel. You think they're worried about it? Not worried about it. They're going to find some way to beat any missile defense they get, which is years away, which right now they can't afford because they don't have an economy that can feed its people. They don't have an economy that can feed their surrogates. Pete Hegseth talked up, too. And he talked about the damage that he thinks took place. Listen.
I can say here that the assessment is that we significantly damaged the nuclear program, setting it back by years. I repeat, years. The Iranian foreign minister, the spokesman, our nuclear installations have been badly damaged. That's for sure. I'm sure that's an understatement. John Ratcliffe, the director of the CIA, putting out a statement just last night. CIA can confirm that a body of credible intelligence indicates Iran's nuclear program has been severely damaged by recent targeted strikes.
Pretty amazing. They pulled it all off a little bit defiant, stunned that the press cannot see the positive, only trying to diminish the operation. And Dems, radio silent or critical? They're saying words like, it's chaos, there's no plan. What more plan? You had us hear the plan today.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
So Gianna Caldwell, Fox News contributor, political analyst, author of a brand new book, The Day My Brother Was Murdered, My Journey Through America's Violent Crime Crisis. Gianna, are you amazed that these left-wing mayors continue to do well in cities that are falling apart because of their left-wing policies?
If you're referring to Tuesday's primary in New York,
and then you got
absolutely.
Brandon Johnson in Chicago.
Correct, Brandon Johnson. But Brandon Johnson was a different era, if you will. He is the lowest-rated mayor in Chicago history.
What is he, 18%?
I don't even know if it's that high.
Really?
That sounds pretty high to me, considering
really?
What we've seen. You know,
I mean,
it's terrible how he's running the city, but this socialist— in New York, my gosh, defund the police?
Do you know he didn't get the black vote?
Yes, I'm aware. Yeah, black voters rejected him. People who are making $50,000 or less rejected him by 20 points for Cuomo. yeah, this guy is a terrible person and is asinine that people actually voted for him, but very low turnout election. We understand that he did get a lot of the young people to jump in on some of the things like rent control and all this other stuff. But then he has this transgender program he wants to do for $65 million. I mean, this is insane kind of stuff. And you would think Democrats had moved past that, considering they lost majorly because of identity politics in the 2024 election with Donald Trump. A lot of the same ideas in which this guy is standing for, Kamala Harris stood for, and the American people rejected it outright.
And AOC, they say, because he endorsed her, because she endorsed him, and endorse him the first time, endorse him again, it puts her in the forefront of getting the 2028 nomination. She's that reaffirms that she's going to run. What do you think about that?
Run for what?
President.
Of what?
I mean,
AOC president of what? Literally, I can't. Now, I know that's a non-starter. So at least we know that there's a much different population in the city of New York than there may be nationally, and yeah. I'm gonna tell you that that's gonna be a non-starter. I can't even imagine her beating anyone in a Democratic primary. They have some people. They don't have much. They don't have really much of a bench.
He's defund the police.
Yeah, he's very much about defunding the police.
Democrats used to be afraid to say that after saying it for during the George Floyd riots.
Or after now they doing that.
Yeah, now he's like, yeah, I want to get social workers out there. How do you feel about that?
I mean, it's idiotic. They already tried this $1 billion in defunding the New York City Police Department, and what did it get them? Death and destruction, more of that.
Less cops. We're still less short cops. By thousands.
I know this is not a popular thing for me to say, but they need a Rudy Giuliani-type figure to come into New York City and clean it up. We don't have that right now. Mayor Adams seems like a nice guy. Never met him. Seems like a nice guy, but he's failed the city of New York as well. With this migrant stuff, like, you spent a lot of money, you disenfranchised New Yorkers, and that's something you got to pay the cost for. Now, I'll give him credit for being the only Democrat, or really being the first Democrat in a major city to say that the Biden administration needs to do something about that. And he took a lot of hits, potentially went to jail for it, or almost went to jail for it. They were prosecuting him for it. But at the same time, it's not been a reigning success under his watch. And I can't imagine anybody in this field really there being one, but I guess he would be the safest option if you were to have to pick.
Here's Bill de Blasio, the worst mayor in America. Maybe if this guy gets the job, he'll be the worst. But listen to him, how happy he was. By the way, he hates Cuomo. Cut 33.
You know, the Mark Twain quote, news of our demise is greatly exaggerated. Let's be clear. If he becomes mayor in January, he said he wants to do several things. He wants to create some free bus networks in New York City. That's something that's happening in cities all over America now. He said he wants to create grocery stores in neighborhoods that don't have enough fresh produce because a lot of supermarkets have been closing. He said he wants to do a rent freeze. That's something we've done before for our rent-regulated apartments. These are not staggering ideas.
Yeah, they are. They're really dumb. And I don't know about the free buses thing.
Yeah, the grocery store thing. Like, you can tell that this is a socialist just by what he says. And I'm going to tell you, for the government to get involved in grocery stores— and then I'm pretty sure they're going to be trying to do price controls. Instead of doing that, why don't you just invite investment in? Why don't you talk about tax
credits? That's not socialism.
I get it, but I'm just saying, a bad idea is simply put a bad idea, and that is a terrible idea. And for people to vote for it is like really a shocker.
So why'd you write the book The Day My Brother Was Murdered? I know you spoke about it. You write My Journey Through America's Violent Crime Crisis because you think it's bigger than just your situation. It's for so many other situations.
Yes, absolutely. And to remind people, on June 24th, 2022, my life changed forever when my innocent teenage baby brother Christian was murdered in Chicago. And since then, I've been out for justice, not just for him, but other families. I created the Caldwell Institute for Public Safety, which I encourage people to go to caldwellinstitute.org and support our efforts there. And additionally, I needed to highlight some of these stories because on that very day, 150 people were murdered across the country. So what did I do? I took 9 stories, including my own brother, and I wrote about those individuals, people like James, who was an Army veteran in Philadelphia. He had PTSD, so he would often go to the park late at night, 1, 2 a.m., and just sit there. And on June 24th, he went to the park, and there were teenagers in that park, young, even some younger than teenagers. And he said, look, what are you all doing out this late? You should go home. And what did they do? They beat him to death with a traffic cone. Or people like Catherine, who was a mother, grandmother, 65 years old, a wife, who was leaving her chemical engineer job and driving down a highway when a drug deal went bad. The person that was trying to sell the drugs and the person that was trying to buy the drugs, they were looking to rip each other off. So then they chase each other down a highway, shooting at each other, and Catherine becomes the victim of violent crime due to that drug deal. Or baby Cecilia, 6 months old, murdered miles away from my little brother. She's in a car with her parents and her brother sitting next to her. They think they hear fireworks, but then the baby brother in the back notices that she's bleeding. Died, 6 months old. There's many of these stories that are extraordinarily tragic, but we've heard a lot about how bad it is. We all know that, but what about the solutions to them? So for the solutions, I talk to people like John Walsh from America's Most Wanted. I talk to Dr. Drew Pinsky about the mental health crisis in America. I talk to our very own Sean Hannity, faith leaders and educators, because we have to do something about this. This isn't something that just impacted my family. It can impact yours.
So with the murders in Chicago in particular, how are the numbers now?
Well, the mayor is claiming that the numbers have been reduced, but we know the data has been manipulated. We saw that when Trump ran and he was having a debate on stage, and I forget if it was a CBS
course. Harris,
they said, oh, no, crime has gone down. He said, no, it hasn't. No, it hasn't. And they said, yes, it has gone down, Mr. President.
Bill Muir,
It actually had not gone down. They manipulated the data. Many of these cities don't even report all the data. And they try to carve out something around migrant crime so it can't be tracked. So are the numbers any better than they have been in the past? I don't think so. Brandon Johnson is claiming that they are. But I've been in Chicago. The city is still in distress.
So what's going to take for things to change?
Brave leadership. People who aren't concerned about their next election. People who aren't concerned about the fame and money that they get or what their donors have to say. They're more concerned about doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lack of bravery in the city of Chicago. There's a lack of bravery here in New York, in many places. But these are heavily leaning, progressive, left-leaning, and they're destructive policies. That's why, again, the Caldwell Institute, caldwellinstitute.org, we're after George Soros-funded prosecutors. I call them political prosecutors because that's exactly what they are. We got involved in the Los Angeles race with George Gascon, put a lot of money into that race, and we supported Nathan Hochman because he was a law and order candidate, somebody who actually wanted to do the job of a prosecutor, and he won. So we're being effective, and this book is a piece of that effectiveness.
Right. So when you talk about things changing, you got to be discouraged, but someone like this would get a nomination. Who says, I'm going to arrest Benjamin Netanyahu, but nobody else.
You know, as I write in my book, The Day My Brother Was Murdered, My Journey Through America's Violent Crime Crisis, Democrats, many of the folks on the left, have just become insane. That's really what it is. Like, these things don't make sense. And it used to be a time where, and you've been around for a very long time, Brian, there used to be a time that the only arguments between both parties was on taxes and abortion. That was it. We knew that law and order had to be the rule of the day. That was always the posture. Mm-hmm. Many, and then even on immigration, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Chuck Schumer, all of them said the same thing that Republicans say today. But now it's become something that they don't want to say because they're controlled by the far, far, far left.
And they want a massive amount of immigration, and they despise the country. So they want to change the country. Curtis Sliwa, Guardian Angels, yes. Volunteer, big law and order guy. He has the Republican nomination. He thinks he's got a real shot this time. Here's Cut 29.
The working women, who are the majority of the workers here, are afraid to take the subways now. They have to grab a cab or Uber, and they can't afford that. And the small landlords and the small business owners are getting taxed, fees, fines, rates that are out of control, that are driving them out of New York City. Just looking tonight, coming here, there were like 8 storefronts that were abandoned. That's the Democrats who did that. You can thank de Blasio. You can thank Cuomo. And you can thank Adams. He's the mayor who's here now, and he's done nothing to correct that.
It's true. There's so many empty. Have you noticed that? You don't come to New York a lot.
I'm here multiple times a month.
Yeah, I can't believe how many stores are just open.
And it's not just New York. It's Chicago, too. Chicago, in my very humble opinion, has the most beautiful downtown of anywhere in the world. And I've been on every continent but Antarctica. But on Michigan Avenue, which was the prize strip for the fancy stores, many of them are still boarded up. Many people have left. People have escaped. They went on to Florida. And I'm going to tell you, if this guy, this socialist, becomes mayor of New York, he's going to be the absolute best realtor that New York has ever had, because everyone's moving to Florida and Texas, just like they did under 2020. This has become an unlivable city for many people, mm-hmm. and the politics have destroyed it.
Yeah, but right now, it's one-party rule. Trump made more progress in New York than any other state.
Yeah.
Any other state.
By the numbers, yeah.
So if you look at the numbers, a lot of people like Elise Stefanik and Mike Lawler says, hey, you know what? We think we want to try running for governor. Do you think this city, this state, is ready to flip parties?
I think the state has a greater chance, but just like any other big state with a major city, you're going to have to run up the numbers here in New York City and in the counties that surround it. You can get other areas of it, because we got other areas of New York State are very conservative.
Long Island, upstate New York.
So there's a lot of opportunity. It's just you got to really imprint here in New York. And it seems to be that this is a bastion of insanity here where some people are following. So they're going to have to really do the work to really, really make that happen. But Lee Zeldin almost did it.
Got within 4 points.
Yeah, he almost did it.
And now he's doing a great job at the EPA. I know you interacted with the president before. How do you think he's doing?
In terms, President Trump has been excellent. This is the best, I think, 2.0. I think this has been the best administration. It's far more organized. You know, I see Pete on television, and I see how he conducts himself, and we knew that he would, because he's an exceptional communicator. But the way that they're organizing, the way they're getting rid of leaks, Pam Bondi, who's someone who joined the board of the Caldwell Institute for Public Safety when we first started, she's been excellent. I've been really pleased by what I've seen. Now, we know that there's going to be issues in any administration, but from what I'm seeing, for the most part, President Trump has been doing an outstanding job, and many of the people in his cabinet have as well.
Yeah, we'll see. If they can get a hold of these cities, it'll really be something, because if the riots happen, he's going to keep with the National Guard. And I hope that's a lesson that Minnesota, Seattle, and Portland understand.
Yeah.
And New York.
Yeah, absolutely. But when you think about the things that President Trump has gone through, the almost assassination twice, the fact that they impeached him multiple times, indicted him multiple times, and, you know, he obviously was actually shot. This is a guy who's like, you know what? We're just going to do things the way that I say they should be done.
Yeah.
We're not going to lean into the politics of it all. We're just going to make it happen, and I appreciate him for it.
Gianno Caldwell, congratulations on the book. It's out this week. It's called The Day My Brother Was Murdered, My Journey Through America's Violent Crime Crisis. Good job, Gianno.
Thank you for
having me. Congratulations on the book. Back in a moment, Brian Kilmeade Show.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
Elon Musk, and I know Elon was on your show, and he's here in Austin, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, and we could talk about Elon, but he spent $270 million to elect Trump as president. Okay. I think that's absurd that any one person...
What's the most someone donated towards the Harris campaign?
They spent a lot of money on Harris as
they
well.
They spent $1.5 billion just
combined
over the course of a couple of months.
You got it.
So what's the problem? You're upset about Elon Musk. Even with Musk's money, Trump had less money earned than Kamala Harris. And she ended up in debt. Trump ran the first time in Hillary Clinton. I think she doubled the amount of money earned. But Bernie Sanders is out on Joe Rogan talking about Elon Musk being the problem. And that's what she says is symbolic of the problem. Well, the whole campaign finance reform, I don't know how they do it. They put it into PACs instead of people because you have a certain limit on how much you can give. But he's out there doing these podcasts. That's what Democrats are doing now. But they're doing podcasts to show his personality. Bernie Sanders is like harmless because, you know, he's never going to run again, number one. Number two, he's a socialist who doesn't want to really run anything. And to me, he never wanted to be president. What he wanted to do is make an impact. He says the same thing every time. He's never run anything. With that, you'd have to understand that capitalism is the only way to fuel an economy like this, and go ahead and taxing the rich gets the rich just to leave the country. So that, to me, was unbelievable. So here's more from his interview with Joe Rogan. I want you to hear what he said about the climate. That 42.
There are some people who think climate change is a hoax. It ain't a hoax.
The reality is that the Earth's temperature has never been static. Scientists have captured the Earth's climate change over the last 485 million years. Here's a surprising place we stand now. So look at the far end of that graph, and you see we're in a cooling period.
Well, I'm not sure. No, I didn't read that article. But all I can tell you is that we are, in my view, going to see more extreme weather disturbances in the coming years than we have ever.
What are you talking about? What are you basing that on? I haven't seen that study. Well, what study did you see? This is what they want to do. They want to take the economy when they want to green the economy. They want to apologize for American history. They don't want to celebrate our 250 years. They talk about inequities because people want to cry and complain rather than take action and change. Just incredible. Just to hear a little bit more. Last one from Bernie Sanders with Joe Rogan. Cut 43.
You are a worker. Your productivity is increasing because we give you AI, right?
Right.
All right. Instead of throwing you out on the street, I'm going to reduce your work week to 32 hours. All right?
So you're going to have 4-day work week.
Exactly. Nice. And by the way, not a radical idea.
A radical idea at all.
There are companies around the world that are doing it with some success.
Okay. So in other words, since you have AI, you only need your 32 hours. So pay you full time. AI does the job. How we do that? I don't know. I don't understand how you have a career for 32 hours a week. Unless you're getting the job in order to have a career on the side, but all he ever talks about is working less. And the other club pursuing the American dream, blame people that you don't have your American dream. That's your thing. Quick thing, if you, I know it seems like a long time away, we're still in June for now, but coming up on August 23rd, we're going to have History, Liberty, and Laughs. After a very successful run in Dayton, we'll go back in Dallas, Texas. That's going to be streamed on Fox Nation, but to be there in person is really where you should be. And by the way, there's going to be specials for Fox Nation if you show up there, just because you show up and you'll get to see what's coming up next. Also, it's a huge venue, so I want to see a lot of you. Already we have a record number of VIPs. Those are the people that come before the show, and I have a chance to talk in a more relaxed setting before things get crazy. In September, Richmond, Virginia on the 27th. So just go to BrianKilmeade.com. Get tickets before it is too late. Thanks so much for listening. Keep it here.
This is Jason Chaffetz from the Jason in the House podcast. Join me every Monday to dive deeper into the latest political headlines and chat with remarkable guests.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com
or wherever you download podcasts.